Ending Life Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to episode 39 of the Clack Swimming for Indie podcast. And you might notice that yet again I'm using this lovely copyright-free Spanish blues guitars music, which is What Pictures, I think, makes it. Get it on YouTube. So we got lots of nice feedback from people from last week's episode, which is always lovely to hear. So thank you very much for that. We do try and put some variety into what we do. So occasionally the odd poem gets thrown in and that kind of thing. So what have we got for you this week? We will be dropping into the Clack's Wifey virtual coffee room as usual. But before we do that, we've got a very interesting report from Lynn, our roving reporter, about a new thing which I hadn't even heard of, and it's called Parler, which is apparently a version of Twitter for people who are so racist and offensive that they've been kicked off Twitter. So, sounds like a delightful place, and Lynn's husband, Neil, has acted as our underground agent and has got himself on this to find out a bit more, so we'll hear that report from roving reporter Lynn in due course. First, we're going to have a couple of short clips from the First Minister's briefing, because it seems to us there's a bit of a change in the air. So we hope you enjoy it. I don't know if anybody else has noticed a bit of a feistiness creeping into the First Minister's daily briefings. She's been patiently answering the most ridiculous, often very rude questions from a pack of, well, let's call them journalists, who are clearly just looking for the next headline. And last week we had Benny Higgins at the briefing. He sort of set the tone a little bit with his response to this particular question about a comment that the Greens had made about the paper that Benny's been involved in, which is to do with restarting the Scottish economy after COVID. And the Greens didn't think it went far enough in its green credentials. So here's what the First Minister and Benny had to say.
Before I hand over to Benny, just in terms of if that is what the Greens have said, can I say Benny's report and the advisory group's report, to be more accurate, has been published now, I think, for less than 2 hours. And I think for any individual party or organisation, simply writing it off in that kind of summary way is a mistake. Let's take the time, as the Scottish Government will, to consider it properly and to see the opportunity that it might offer us.
Yeah, thanks, First Minister. And I would echo that comment. I'd be curious to hear precisely what they think is missing, or what could have been reinforced more. We make it very clear that we want a green spine to the recovery. We actually used an approach to analysis which is based on four pillars of capital. Firstly, the old-fashioned one of financial and physical capital, natural capital, human capital and social capital, and made the point very clearly that each pillar of capital is equally important. When we talk about conditionality, the green conditions associated with conditionality of interventions is very clear. I must say, as I went virtually around the country and we received many submissions, there were people who were prepared to say that they thought more needed to be done, but they weren't very good at telling me what it was. But fortunately, we had enough very good submissions that we were able to curate for this report.
And the First Minister seems to have been inspired by Benny's robust response, and she tried a couple of her own this week. First, a question from the Daily Telegraph.
Okay, I covered this at length yesterday, so I'm not going to repeat everything I said then. I'll make the observation again that last week, of course, I was, you know, being asked questions almost every day at this briefing about why we weren't bringing children back full time. This week it's been, why are we seeking to bring children back full time? We're trying to do the best for children, and we're trying to do it safely, and I think that is what everybody should expect from a government.
And here's the Daily Mail's question.
Compensation for retailers.
Well, I know the Daily Mail often thinks I should just follow the UK government, but interestingly, I don't think I should blindly follow anybody. I think I should make the decisions that I think are right for Scotland. That's my job and my duty. But, you know, retail opened in England before the decision taken this week by the UK government to give flexibility, not abandon the 2 metre, because that's not what they've done in England, but give more flexibility. I've got to take these decisions on the basis of the best advice and the best evidence. Moving away from 2 metres is not consequence-free, it's not risk-free, it increases the risk. So I've got to go through with my advisers and the rest of the government a process of assuring ourselves that we understand that risk and we can mitigate it. I understand and I hear loudly and clearly the economic arguments for more flexibility around 2 metres, and I hope we can get there. But I've got to do that carefully so that we're not putting lives at risk, because lives really matter too. And if this virus starts to go out of control again, that doesn't help the economy. So I will continue to take these decisions in a careful and cautious way. And, you know, I heard somebody say yesterday, somebody in the media, I can't remember who it was, and I wouldn't name them even if I could, say Scotland's lagging behind the rest of the UK in opening up the economy. Well, that's not strictly true. We're perhaps a couple of weeks behind England. But flip that the other way round right now. England is lagging behind Scotland in the suppression of this virus. Our case numbers are falling faster and they're at a lower level. The numbers of people dying are now at a lower level proportionately than in England. So what that says to me is the approach we are pursuing is working. So let's stick at it and build that sustainable and lasting recovery for our economy that we need. And that means when we're changing any of the advice around this, we've got to do so carefully. And I think that is in the long-term interest of the economy as well as in the long-term interest of the health of the country.
Okay, this is Sunday, 28th of June. This is Lynn, roving reporter for Clack's Wifey. I've roved all the way into my husband's man cave. We're going to have a discussion about Parler, which is a relatively new form of social media that's being used. You can tell us more about it, but we've been talking about all the different forms of communication, from your traditional broadsheets to the news, and now the prevalence of social media as a way of disseminating information and also communicating with one another. And as of late, there's been quite a few people have been removed from the likes of Twitter because people have complained about the nature of their postings. And they all seem to have jumped ship to this new social media called Parler. So tell us a bit more about Parler, Neil.
Well, it's a relatively new thing, as you say. It's only been on go a couple of years. It emanates from somebody, I can't even remember his name, I don't think it's that important. The whole principle of it is that it's all about free speech in inverted commas. So a couple of years ago, it only had a couple of 100,000 people involved in it. Then all of a sudden it jumped up because as a result of the Khashoggi affair in Saudi Arabia, loads of Saudis jumped ship from Twitter because they were all banned because of mass manipulation by the Saudis of Twitter. And so they all looked for alternative sites. And there are many alternative sites for people to go to. And the trouble is that this particular one is a chosen one for all the neoliberalist, right-wing, fascist, homophobic, racist, anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim, anything you like kind of people to jump on the bandwagon. There was a concerted effort very recently, again, to exit Twitter en masse as a kind of demonstration and head to Parler instead. And so Eric Trump, Donald's laddie, is already there, and he was encouraging him to do it. Although Donald himself doesn't obviously want to do that because he's got such an enormous following on Twitter that he can't possibly leave that and jump ship at this particular moment in time. So it's really an alternative method for them to be uncensored, put all sorts of crap out there. They regard it as a sort of sacred place where they can be a kind of bubble, if you like, where they're sacrosanct and they don't have any other opinions other than their own. There is very little anti-commentary to whatever you say. So whoever you are on this medium, and most of the news feed is very Trumpian and conservative and right-wing, then you are very, very unlikely to have anybody who will contradict you. And that gives you immense freedom at the moment to establish a kind of new colony of right-wing belief. So it's incredibly disturbing, the number of people who are on it. They're well known here. Incredibly disturbing when you look at the number of members of Westminster who are on it already. We've been flocking to it in the last week. So I'm a newcomer to it, obviously.
So where, for example, somebody puts something on Twitter that goes against their guidelines, they can be blocked or banned or kicked off or have their account suspended. There's all these different measures in place, but that's not the case in Parler. But are there not... I mean, Twitter's obviously worldwide, as is Facebook. I'm assuming Parler is too.
Yeah.
But do they not have any form of self-governance, or is that the beauty of it, that like you're free to say what you like?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I kind of saw was that when you sign up to it, in terms of the terms and conditions, you act as a guarantor against any legal action against Parler per se. So in effect, what you're doing is you're setting yourself up as a spokesperson on this site. But any subsequent actions or legal repercussions that come as a result of anything that goes on this site, they're on you. And you sign up to the fact that you will protect this site in particular. So it's kind of indemnifies itself against any possibility of
repercussions. So they're just saying we're just a vehicle. We're just a soapbox to stand on, and anything you say that's reprehensible or illegal or incites racial hatred, etc., you have to deal with that yourself. It's a bit like, I suppose, companies who, when they take on employees and they train them, basically they say, well, we've given you training in equality or in diversity so that if you do anything in your role as, you know, a salesperson working for whatever company, and a complaint's raised about you about something you said that was racist or sexist or whatever, the company can say, well, we gave you training on that. So it's not us. You've had the training from us. This is down to you. It's making the individual accountable. The company's sort of negating any accountability. So Parler are saying, no, we're not going to be accountable for anything that's on this site. The individual that's put it on, we're just the place they can put it.
Not only that, I think that it's possible as well that if you read through terms and conditions, which nobody ever does, you'll find that in quoting things from Parler, they probably have some sort of small print in there that says that you can't quote it, or you can't use it, or you can't attribute it, or all this kind of thing. So it's almost like a total fortification in terms of social media, which is probably untested up until now because it's so relatively new. So that's why they're all in there. But when you see some of the conversations, you see them chatting to one another about this kind of thing and say, oh, what do you think about this? And then that kind of goes into the background because they're too busy being full of hate or hostile to somebody or that kind of thing. So this will all be tested in time. But at the moment, it is the a la mode thing for all these people to join in on. And so it's terrifying in a sense, because when you're in this kind of vacuum of legality and in a particular situation that we're in, where all these people are orchestrating violence on the streets, which is what they actually do all the time, every day, and where they're pushing out all their hate messages, then it makes you wonder how long they'll get away with it and how long before it all collapses and burns.
But also, it kind of, or does it speed up the process? Because these people are finding out where each other are. Before there was social media, before there was, that's probably true of, for example, people that are interested in Scottish independence, because we can go on various Facebook groups or whatever, we've managed to make links with people in other areas that we wouldn't necessarily have got to know as quickly as we have got to know through using social media. So is it potentially the same for these, what we view as particularly nasty groups that we don't want to be gaining any sort of traction and building up in numbers, but they've got the opportunity to do that?
Well, you could see it as all sorts of different ways. You could see it as a retreat from normal media because they can't cope with normal media anymore. You could see it as a new fortification whereby the more and more of them sort of grow from that. You can also see it from an intelligence perspective. So they're all gathered together.
They're all there. We know who they basket. Are.
Yeah. So you can actually look at them and say, that, well, we know who you are now and what have you. But to do that, you've got to be on the site and look at them and observe them. So there's 101 probably different permutations of that. But at the moment, just to give you an example, in Scotland, as a result of the stabbings in Glasgow, Tommy Robinson, Katie Hopkins, a guy called David Vance in particular, who's based in Northern Ireland, all these people are pushing all sorts of news feeds from that event that happened, which are very biased, very detrimental. They associate with other feeds. For example, there was an incident in Glasgow today, no idea what it was, some sort of incident on the streets, and they link it directly back to the reference, the stabbings, even though there is no direct link. So they say somebody was injured because of a fight in Glasgow today, that person stayed in the same hotel as the incident where the stabbings occurred. So they continually push out this message. It's all about immigration. It's all about these people living here when they don't deserve to live here. It's all about colour. So it's a horrific thing. And there's a huge sort of concentration at the moment in Scotland because that's the most recent event. Other events have happened in the last 24 hours or so elsewhere, but the most crucial one has been Scotland. So the big focus at the moment is Scotland. But you'll see also reflections from London. There was minor incidents in London. You'll see events in America. They'll reflect continuously on the BBC and the media. They are totally paranoid, probably ironically as much as we are about the BBC. They see the BBC and the media as being anti them. They're far more inclined to discuss armed struggle all the time as a sort of a revolution that they're going to have to stand up and survive and move on. They are the ultimate winners, and wherever the money goes, they will follow, all this kind of stuff. So you see all these Trumpian narratives. Mm-hmm. So it's a real eye-opener when you see what they're all chatting about.
I did see an interesting post from a friend who lives in Glasgow and makes the point like that the whole thing has been horrific. However, he's making the point that, yeah, Glasgow's improved over the years, but it's not been unknown that there has been knife crime in Glasgow or in Scotland. It's almost like the favoured method of violence. Thankfully, yes, it has changed over recent years. There's been lots of work done to make improvements, make the communities safer. However, the reaction to it has been so sort of, you know, that's, I think he used the expression, before you clutch your pearls and exclaim, this never happens in Glasgow, you know, take a long, hard look at yourself and look at the history of what's gone on there before, and look at the behaviour of the Westminster government, which is who have powers over immigration, how they're removing refugees. They had this changing the locks policies. They've put them into, they're saying it's hotels, but it's not. They're basically being described by other people as, no, it's like being in a prison cell. You're served the same food every day. It's not a nice hotel room with a minibar in it and you order from the room service. People have been ripped from where they had been beginning to integrate into communities and chucked back basically in a, what's effectively a detention centre.
And don't get me wrong, you'll not see any narrative such as you've just dictated there that equates to a fair position on why people are here or the reasons behind immigration or anything like that. You will always get the narrative on Parler that these people are vermin, that these people should be exterminated, that these people come from ISIS, they're all terrorists. No matter what the incident is, it's always terrorism, that these people are landing on the beaches every day in life. You will always get this kind of narrative. You're never going to get a fair picture from Parler. You're going to get the picture that you want from Parler, which is the same narrative repeated all every day, 24 hours a day, by the same people, one of whom I've already reported for hate crime on my short period of time on the site. And what they also do is they manipulate news and recent news. So, for example, in relation to Glasgow, again, David Vance has linked recent demonstrations in Glasgow before the stabbing attack, whereby the Green Brigade, which are obviously the Celtic Football Club sort of faction, if you like, they had a peaceful protest, relatively peaceful, through Glasgow in favour of immigration, in favour of people residing in Glasgow. There was no trouble. They were actually kettled at some point by the police, which I think was a bad decision by the police. But anyway, nonetheless, David Vance has tried to turn that demonstration into a sort of goading on Parler to get them back out on the streets, if you like, and justify themselves, and to try and get the various National Front modern movements back on the streets to fight them. So you have this kind of underlying narrative, if you like, whereby he's encouraging, guys like David Vance are encouraging one side to do things, and on the other side, there's peaceful demonstration. They're trying to link everything in together, but perhaps there's no link whatsoever.
So they're conflating issues.
Yes. So, I mean, if you take it down to the basic levels of sectarianism, then you're in big trouble, because obviously you can incite violence between Protestants and Catholics, and you can take it back to the lowest common denominator again.
Just onto your point, saying you spoke to the police, you'd seen something and you contacted the police and said this is inciting racial hatred or violence or whatever. How do they, what do they consider as the locus of that crime? Because this is potentially somebody on a computer, and it could be anywhere in the world, that's trying to have an impact on the streets of Glasgow,
for example.
So what's the kind of jurisdiction of the police then? How do they with that?
Well, for one thing, the person I've reported resides in, or pertains to reside in, the United Kingdom. So that's the first thing. Although I have no idea where that person resides in reality. The second thing is you phone a police office and you get a call handler who is completely oblivious to any of the background information. So they have to speak to other people. And before long, it gets lost in various sort of thoughts and narratives and is invariably probably not turned into a crime. Usually because the person in the first place hasn't said enough. He's caged these words enough to just create enough mischief without actually committing the crime. Although that, of course, is for the courts and not really for the police. The police are there to report all these things. So this is the trouble. You can have all these people orchestrating all this all the time, and then all of a sudden somebody will respond to it in some sort of violent way on the streets. And, you know, we've seen it time and time before. People say, I did it because I heard somebody saying this about this on social media. So it is very, very difficult to interpret laws on these kind of things. And certainly when you phone up, it's not an ordinary
process. Is it a telecommunications act that it goes under, the kind of social media side of things? I mean, when you look at like the cyberbullying, I mean, the local schools here have police officers that liaise with them. And having spoken to them when we had children at school, it was interesting that they said 75% of their involvement with schools is dealing with internet interactions, cyberbullying or otherwise. And it almost sounds like that's young people doing it, but it's now moved on to adults using that same sort of forum to manipulate other people into doing things.
Yeah, so it's a bit like ISIS did with all the people who became indoctrinated with their thing. This is exactly the same thing as what's going on the right-wing factions. And so in terms of the law, there are a number of offences, specifically in British law, which date back and are amended from various other laws. And so you really have to be an expert in the law to look at it. In terms of infringement of social media, then it clearly Parler's not in the least bit interested. Otherwise, they would all be banned immediately. So these are things that instantly on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, or they would be banned from saying. But they are very cagey what they're doing. So when I say that this particular person, for example, says he's saying things that I think will incite violence between one faction or another, I've no way of proving that. I've no way of... This is just my insight into it, if you like, my interpretation of his words. And a million other people would interpret it a million other ways.
Yeah.
So it's all contextual, it really is. But it's right up there for grabs. But there's imaging as well. So some of the imaging that get from Glasgow wouldn't be allowed as well. And what these people put, they put up the worst possible. It's always blood on the streets. So there was a stabbing victim on the steps in Glasgow that was portrayed on Parler that you would never have seen on Facebook or on Twitter because it would have been taken down instantly. Somebody being attended to, getting first aid and blood literally streaming down the steps of Glasgow Hotel. It would never have been seen, but yet you can see it on this site. So, I don't know. The mere fact that in this country so many Tory MPs are signing up for it, it's almost like a virus in itself. They're multiplying, you know, one joins, then two joins, then four joins, then eight join, and it goes up like that. And they're all Brexiteers, they're all right-wing. It's all very much the new model of government. They're all very cagey in their initial postings and stuff. And they're all very follow trains of thought, for example, on statues or whatever it is, and make sure they put their oar in. But fundamentally, the whole site is highly racist, highly inflammatory. So it's not for the faint-hearted.
Okay, thank you for sharing that with us. And we'll look forward to it being closed down at some point in the near future.
Well, you would sincerely hope so.
Hello, and welcome to this week's Wifey Clacks podcast. This week we have a lot of discussion on life balance and productivity in the context of lockdown. So over we go to the ladies on Zoom.
See, in England, they're really cutting back on the building regulations. They just go, right, what would we like to do here, regardless of the environment, regardless of everything else? Right, that law's in the way, we'll get rid of
it. They also got rid of a lot of regulation around housing, so that property developers could turn office blocks into accommodation pods, and so they had to get rid of a lot of house building regulations around that, because, you know, a home has to have a certain size and rooms have to be a certain size, and they got rid of that, so go ahead with that. So families were ending up living in these basically office blocks with no access for storage or where they would hang their washing or where children would play.
It really sets up problems in the future when you have to do housing adaptations, because you're always fitting person, environment and activity together. And if the environment you started off with is an absolute no-goer, then you've got relocation, and then everything that means for that family and all their social connections, everything that is involved in their life.
Can I tell you about our building? When this place was on the market, I thought this will work. Literally hours before signing the final planning permission, building regulations, oh my goodness, we suddenly looked at everything and thought, oh, we're not going to be able to live in this. Even though the family that lived it for us, they'd lived in it for 10 years and the people before that had lived in it forever. So this is my accolade to Clack Manor Council. Phoned up my lawyer, stop stop because they'd said, in theory, to the planning regulations, which if not possible, we'd have to pull the building down and start again. There's no difference to my house and hundreds of other houses of that era. So what did they do? They convened the whole planning committee and all the building people just for us, and they said, how can we make this work? So that is my accolade, having lived in Stirling for so long. And I just know if this had been in Stirling, they would have just looked at the rules and went, and can't be done, and that would have been the end of it.
Do you think now that there's been all these changes with working from home, so there's been lots of, say, for example, call centres where they've discovered that people can work from home and it actually suits the person and it suits the employers as well, because they're potentially looking, going, why do we need this big building with 300 people in it when people are working just as well from home? There's potentially going to be lots of buildings out there that are no longer going to be needed for what they're being used for at the moment. So there's going to be potential buildings that could be turned into urban farms, all these ones where they put the lighting in and grow fruit and veg inside them.
The difficulty is in some communities is actually getting past the communities themselves. A lot of communities don't like change. Very difficult.
So it's being kind of clever about going to the communities and basically putting the words in their mouths. Oh, that's a great idea. Why didn't we think of that? Why don't we plant on top of the bus shelters, etc., etc.? The
pandemic has been fantastic for loosening up people's thinking, because things that you would never have considered before, suddenly we've had to do because we've had no choice. And again, they were giving the example of joining up bits of the health service. Suddenly, by the end of the week, bang, there's your new system.
Why you have to go and sit in an outpatient's appointment, sitting waiting for an hour and then to have 3 seconds and the consultant doesn't even look at you. Why didn't you just phone me? What a waste of money.
Yeah, that whole kind of consultation over Zoom might have taken decades to bring in. And yet now it's like, oh goody, I'm Zoom.
Yeah, the physio practice where I go, well, I go and see the sort of sports therapist there, but the physio that runs it said because she had patients that she would see regularly but couldn't in the clinic anymore, she was having Zoom meetings with them and talking them through the exercises they were to do and correcting them. She was watching them and then correcting them. And she said she's going to continue with that because for some of these patients, it's really difficult for them actually to get into the clinic in the first place. So she can continue with her treatment of them. I don't know that every appointment would be like that, and if it makes their life easier, and even just for people that are a wee bit further away, saving on half an hour to drive and get there and then half an hour back from it, that takes an hour out of the time that it takes to do that, saving everybody time.
It does. What's interesting about it, though, I was speaking to a friend of mine who's about to qualify as a counsellor. She's had a complete career change. And she said that though she's been contacting her clients, and most of her colleagues have also been contacting their clients over, you know, Zoom or an equivalent, what they've also then done is make sure that they've reduced the number of clients that they see in a day, because of the nature of their role, because they can't do direct eye contact, because they can't do body positioning and body language and that kind of exchange. It's actually taking more out of them in terms of communication and energy. And because you have to factor that in, rather on the surface with stats, they'll go, but come on, we've reduced that travel time. So now you've got this extra time to fit more people in. And I think there's a real risk there of looking very cold-heartedly at some stats and not seeing the technicolor in between that of actually what the value of those communications needs to be like and how to compensate for that.
Because in the universities, we had to shift really quickly to online teaching within like a week. We had to try and get everything online, and it was an exhausting time. But even once we got everything up and running, I found I was teaching a 2 hour lecture a week, and I found it was taking me much longer to prepare all the work, to prepare presentation, to get everything online and give them extra online links that they could go to, a discussion board that we could chat and also do live sessions, was taken up. Rather than spending 5.5 hours per week on it, I was spending about like 2 days and the emails and everything. That was so this idea that online teaching just works as well as face-to-face class teaching, I found it really exhausting. So I think we have to be very careful on that also when we think about working from home and how convenient it is. And it is convenient, but at the very beginning, because we locked down about a week before the announcement, and people, you know, were talking to other colleagues and saying, well, how do you feel? I said, well, I feel all right, because it just feels like a bit like doing my PhD, you know, when you're isolated and writing up, you know, and everything's, you're locked everything up and you're just sitting at your computer. But after a while, my work life and home life began to merge, and you're not getting that clear boundaries of time, that clear, you know, going to work and coming home from work. And my desk is in my living room because my kids were still living at home when I set up my office space. So I was working and relaxing in the same space, and I felt I wasn't getting that clear temporal difference. And I just felt I was never escaping from work. I was exhausted about halfway through all this lockdown. I was really exhausted.
When I was teaching, and I can remember one morning going in and a head teacher I didn't particularly get on with, you've not responded to my email. And I was like, well, it's not even 9 o'clock in the morning yet. Technically, I haven't started working. I haven't seen your email yet because I'm preparing for the class to come in and getting set up for the morning. And when I did get around to looking at the emails, she'd sent it at 2 in the morning. And I wasn't expecting, or she was expecting me to have read that and responded to it. And eventually, I mean, I told her quite probably not politely, actually, which is why I ended up not working there anymore. But eventually, Falkirk Council stopped you being able to access your work email at home, because there became this expectation that you were available all the time.
You're accessible all the time.
Yeah. And what you were saying, Maggie, about like having defining your areas at home as well. And because all the clients I work with, I know I've been and I've physically met them, and I do remotely work with them sometimes anyway, because we've got clients up in Inverness. So if I'm doing an audit, I can go and look at their system online and do it and then have a conversation with them. But I have been there and I have met them and I've kind of built up that relationship. I think it's a bit easier, but if you were just to do that with a client you've never met, you've not got any of the niceties of getting to know them. And so the people I work for, you know about their families and stuff like that, and you might not have the same opportunity if it was just an online. It's very, very transactional, as opposed to actually being a kind of working relationship.
You know what I used to find, that when I used to work, I worked regularly from home, often because I was travelling a lot, and all these things you're talking about, exactly what we had to build in, those of us who worked from home, and we had to, you know, separating off your, when are you going to start and when are you going to finish, and it's okay to go and have a chat with somebody for a bit of social light relief rather than battering away for 12 hours. But see, when I really found it different was when I retired and I started doing voluntary stuff, first of all with the community trust and now with the radio. And you just find that there's no boundaries on that, because it never started off as a traditional job.
But even with volunteering, where you're supposed to have a choice, you know, where you can say no and it's free choice, you find actually those boundaries around time, like you said, Fiona, kind of go out the window when people contact you all sorts of times of the day and expect you to do things and answer. And it's sometimes you feel obliged, and that quite often is the case. You feel obliged to answer, obliged to do something, because it's voluntary, it's for someone else, it's for the greater good. But you say, no, I'm not doing that, or I'm not answering that email, or I've removed my work email from my phone. But because it's a voluntary thing, it's a community thing, because those boundaries around time and about when you work are kind of all blurred and merged together.
If not kids, you've got a structure that you've got to work around anyway if they're in school. And we did a consultation to see that, you know, if we took away core times that people had to be at work, and we had a flexi system, if we took away core times, what would people choose to work? And actually, most people choose to work pretty much what they're already doing, because the reason they're already doing that is because it fits in with their school kids' start time, or when they pick them up from the childminder, or what day they're parents are available to babysit, or whatever it is, and that tends not to change week by week.
So I was going to say, they did some interesting trials down south with school times. They found that teenagers didn't work well first thing in the morning, so they started the school, they had a condensed day, and they started the school at 10 o'clock in the morning, and they found that between, you know, 10 and 4, that was better, that the students worked better. They weren't, because they're saying teenagers just need that, they need more sleep. And you remember your, as babies, you were like, oh, please, will they go to sleep? And then they get to be teenagers, and you're like, when are they getting up? You know? But that worked quite well. They had the school day starting at 10 o'clock, and they just shortened the breaks and shortened the lunch hour as well, so they could still get it into times that fitted in around everybody else's lives, like parents as well.
I think it's a societal thing as well, because if you go to other places, like in Europe or even in the States, some of their universities are starting at 7:30 in the morning. I was over in Malta on a project I'm working on, and their kids start at 7:30 in the morning, even young kids at, you know, nursery age, because, and they finish about lunchtime because it's too hot in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. So they're starting at 7:30 in the morning and finishing at 1:30 or 2:00 in the States. And the universities maybe start at 8:00 in the morning, where ours don't start till 9:00. Because it's kind of British, it's kind of 9 to 5, although time's really embedded in the society that you live in, you know. And then if you go to other cultures, we live a very fast-paced life, a fast-paced society where speed related to success and efficiency and doing things well. The faster you do things, you get more things done. And then in other cultures, being very taking your time and slowing down and relaxing is seen as being more successful and doing things better because you're taking your time to do something.
Shutdown has maybe changed some of those attitudes.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's really given us a chance to slow down and kind of ponder and contemplate and take those opportunities to slow ourselves down. I think people really enjoy it. Some people find it really difficult. Some people who enjoy working at a really fast pace don't even enjoy going on holiday because they don't know what to do when they've got free time. Find it really difficult to adjust. And this has kind of been forced upon us. And I think for those...
But there's also been that cultural pressure on people to not look like they're not being productive, which I think a lot of this comes down to, is that guilt that people are played into by other people, always thinking somebody's watching over their shoulder, and they're not deciding to make a difference between what is actually productive in terms of actually coming up with something, which might actually take you 2 hours or something if you're left within the right time frame for you to get on with it, as opposed to spending even longer on it because you're expected to work over that period, and also because you can't look not busy, which really doesn't play into any kind of evidence that we have about health at all. The other thing that I wanted to mention was just absolutely your point, Maggie, about the societal norms about a 9-to-5 lifestyle and things. But for me, and I've done shift working in the past, I'm going to assume that Anne has as well, the whole shift working pattern, you do become invisible.
And I think this lockdown and this kind of slow pace and taking time to kind of reflect was like an opportunity for us all to really think about the way that we live.
Even though I'm allowed out because I've been shielding, I'm allowed out. There's just so many people round about and they're not keeping the distance. Mm-hmm. And there's groups of teenagers. And you can't see that they're in the one house or an extended family or anything like that. And I'm thinking, I can't keep 2 metres from people. I'm stuck in the house as if I'm shielding again. I probably end up going to my mum's and sitting in her garden because mine is like a shared garden. And the neighbours upstairs are teenagers and they had a party during lockdown 3 times. But they're not exactly considerate.
Casey, is there anything we can do to help?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Do you want to come round and sit in our gardens?
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. And I won't make you go to the garden loo. We can let you use the inside toilet now.
I'm not allowed inside anybody's house.
Oh, well, in that case, you can use the garden loo. It's still there.
See, the information for shielders, absolutely super. Like when Boris came out telling about the English system, about shielding's virtually stopped, I got a text saying, you're not in England, you're in Scotland, this is your rules. You know, so you got loads and loads of information. So I've actually had a really good reaction to the government information.
That's good to hear. But share the good and bad, Tracy, like the lack of consideration from your neighbours, because it seems to be people are either thinking about everybody. Now, we could be in our family, we've got nobody really that's on a vulnerable list, so we could go, oh, what the hell, we don't have to bother about it. But we've been like, you know, whereas other people, and you've seen it, you're looking going, that's 5 non-identical quintuplets there, clearly not from the same house. So I think it's interesting, like thinking from the kind of the mindset of people, why are some people we're all being inconvenienced, but we're doing it because it's the right thing for everybody. And why are some people just going, I don't give a fuck about anybody else?
Some people are just like that, though, because it's not even an age thing. I mean, James had one of his pals round, and the pair of them, they sat in the looked out the window, were sitting in the garden on opposite ends of the bench, keeping the, this is two guys,
in their 20s, you know, chatting away. Mm-hmm. And nobody's looking at them. So they chose to obey the rules for good reasons. You know, they're not wanting to take anything back home. But some people just don't.
I think it was the Saturday. We were allowed to meet with people, one person or one group, on the Friday, but it was raining. So it was a Saturday, it was really sunny. My mum came round to me because my car wouldn't start. We were sitting out in the back on the grass, 6 feet apart. The neighbours from upstairs came and sat between us. So we actually had to get up and move. Yeah, me and my mum ended up about 12 metres apart. So we were shouting at each other across the neighbours. So this is what fast, I'm coming up.
So that's it for this week. And it's also a chance for me to give you a reminder that if you are interested in doing podcasts yourself, but you're feeling a wee bit nervous about it, then actually Indie Live might be a really good place for you to start yourself. And it's no harm in just dropping us an email. If Wifey Clacks have managed to get into it, then there really isn't a reason for somebody else not to give it a go. And it's always good to hear a different perspective or something new. So as it is for this week, this is Finn giving you a socially distant sign off and hoping that you're keeping well.
And as Finn said there, that's it from us for this week. So thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch with us at all, you can get us on our Facebook page, Clackmannanshire Women for Independence, or our Twitter account, which is @ClacksWifeyWFI. Or if you want to get in touch with Indie Live Radio, as Finn mentioned there, maybe you've got a podcast idea you'd like to try out, which we'd love to hear about. You can get in touch with Indie Live Radio through their Facebook page or their Twitter account, or by email, studio@indielive.radio. See you next week. Bye now.
In life.